And then I'd ask that you please help me welcome Treehouse Dave from La Crescenta.
Good evening, everybody. My name is David Delvis, and I am an alcoholic. And first off, it's good to be sober. It's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Lee for asking me to come out here and share with you guys tonight. I'm one of those people that believes it's always a good deal and a good opportunity to be able to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like that tradition of reading the long form of the tradition of whichever month it is. I kind of like that. I think I might take that back. I'm going to steal that. Take that Arch Army. I don't know if they'll do it or not. Hell, I'm the secretary. It doesn't matter. I'll do it anyway. You know, it's right of decision. Anyway, never mind. I actually love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. And welcome to the new people. I know we got a couple of hands here tonight. Can I see the hands of the people with like less than a year of sobriety? How many people in this room have like less than a year of sobriety? Excellent, excellent. Welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And welcome to A New Way of Life, if you're anything like me. This is something I didn't think was going to work, and I thought I was wasting my time when I came in here. I'm going to tell you a quick story about Lee for a minute here. And what happened was a couple of months back, Katie was our secretary of our speaker meeting down the hill on Sunday night. And back when she became secretary, she took it upon herself she was going to get the best possible speaker she could. And she got a list, and she called the people, and she got a hold of different people, and she got a hold of Lee. And she'd scheduled Lee to speak at our meeting on Sunday night on his birthday in December. And I don't know what kind of grand ideas you get, but I got this grand idea that since it was his AA birthday, I was going to cook him up a barbecue. You know, that's what my idea was. And we're going to do some steaks and all that kind of stuff. Well, it just so happens that week, you guys had that big fire down in Santa Barbara, and it blocked all the roads, and he ended up not making it. And anyway, we rescheduled him, and he came down about a month and a half later, 2 months later, and we still had the barbecue. And as a result of that, a mutual friend of ours, Doug and Carla, who live in the same neighborhood, heard about it and said, oh, they'd love to come over and have dinner along with him, hear him talk and all that kind of stuff, and just bond and connect like we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, this fellowship that we crave so much. And they came down, Carla is a vegetarian, and she's a vegan, and we're eating steaks, you know, and it's just like, and so she brought her own stuff. We didn't know this, and she brought her own stuff, and she brought a big plate of stuff, and there was a whole bunch of it left over. And you want to talk about there being no waste in God's economy. And Katie goes, oh, yeah, you know, that's fine. She goes, I'll eat it. I like vegetables and all that kind of stuff. I don't. I'm going to probably die of scurvy someday. But, you know, that's just the way it is. And sure enough, we had it in the refrigerator. And the very next day, one of Katie's very, very good friends that she knew, she watched this guy come and get sober. His cat passed away. Over the night, it was a lot of problems, and I don't know if you've ever had a pet that's passed away, and it was a big struggle for him, and he didn't eat all that night and all that next day, and he ends up coming over, and he's falling apart, and Katie says to him, you know, when was the last time you ate? And he goes, you know what, I'd love to eat anything, but you know what, I'm a vegetarian, I'm a vegan. And Katie looks at us, we have a whole plate of vegan food in our refrigerator. No waste in God's economy, I absolutely guarantee it. I love that, I absolutely love that. And I love what happens around here. And that's just nothing planned out that way, that's just the way it worked out. But I really love that, you know, and I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 24 years old. I don't know how old anybody else, or how old you were when you came in, but that's how old I was when I came in. I was 24 years old. And just to kind of give you a snapshot of what I look like, I weighed about 110 pounds. If you look at me now, I'm about 165, give or take. So you got to picture me about 55 pounds lighter than I am now. So you know, I'm not a big guy as it is. So we're talking like if I turned sideways, I would disappear. I mean, we're talking like I was just sucked up. And I was dying of this disease. And I would come to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would hear the people share at the meetings. And I really didn't identify with a lot of the stuff going on. I didn't identify with the people were sharing. I didn't think you guys had anything to offer me. But I was really hopeless. And I know we had quite a few people raise their hand. I know we had some people that were really new. And I hope you're as hopeless as I was when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was absolutely hopeless when I got here. And dying of this disease. And the thing is that even if you're that way, a lot of the times, it's not enough. It's not enough if you're somebody like me. And I still had some vestiges, some pride, some ego, and I was still not sure if I could do this kind of thing or if I could get and stay sober. And I wasn't sure if it was going to work, and I thought I was wasting my time, but I didn't know what else to do. And I just started doing the stuff they said around here. And I am so grateful that I don't have to believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for it to work in my life, you know. And as a result of just coming in here and doing the stuff that they said around here, it's been quite a few years now. And when I came in here, I didn't look like Mike Pence, you know. I actually had like brown hair, and I was a young kid, it was just the way it was, you know. And I never planned on living past the age of 25 years old. That my goal was to die when I was 25 years old. Is there anybody in this room besides me that gave themselves death dates out there? Anybody else? There's always at least some of us. Actually, that's quite a few people. And if you're anything like me, the reason we give ourselves death dates is because we get this question. I don't know if you've ever had this question presented to you, where people start going, what are you going to do with your life? And I always felt cornered by that particular question when they would ask it to me. And my pat answer, and I'll get into that in a little bit, was that I was just going to die when I was 25 years old. And that's what I plan on doing. And, you know, I'm one of those people that also believes it's important for me to tell you what I was like out there. I don't know about anybody else in here. I always like to say that when I go to a speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have expectations of the speaker. I don't know if you have expectations of me up here tonight, but when I go to a speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have expectations of the speakers. I do. And I'm looking for three basic things. I want to laugh. I want to cry. And I want to hear the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about anybody else. I want a lot for my dollar. I really do. You know. And then I want to go out for coffee, talk crap about the speaker. That's what I like to do. I don't know about anybody else. That's what I like to do. And over the course of the years, and I like speaker meetings. I've heard a lot of really good speakers. And I think one of the ones that I used to hear all the time is they say something like this. You all know what it's like to drink and get loaded out there. So I'm just going to talk about sobriety. And then, for whatever time you get them to stand up there and talk about AA and all that kind of stuff, and it's neither here nor there, but to me, I think that's a disservice to every person that raised their hand with like less than a year of sobriety. Because when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous and I would hear those people share, I didn't get it. It didn't make any sense to me. It's like a vision for you, but it really doesn't lead me anywhere. You know, all my life, I had had people trying to lead me places, telling me what was good for me, telling me this is what I should do. And I don't know about anybody else in here, but when I had people telling me that kind of stuff, I'd say, yeah, you're right. Because intellectually, something inside of me would say, yeah, they're probably right. But something deep down inside of me would kind of be going, nah, not really, because they really don't understand where I'm at, where I'm coming from, you know. And that's just the way it was. So I like to tell you what I was like out there. I think it's important, you know. And they always tell you the formula is what it was like, what happened, and what we're like today. Big Book actually says it a little differently. It says it's going to tell you how I was able to find a God and able to stay sober as a result of that. But I'm still supposed to tell you my story. I really am. I think it's really important. I love the fact. I absolutely love the fact that if you look at the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, not a bit, I'm a bit of a student of the book. I'm not always 100% spot on, but I like the history of the book. Bill Wilson's story is 16 pages long. And he's drunk for 13 pages. I don't know about anybody else, but I kind of caught that. You know, like I'm looking at him, and he's drunk during a lot of that. You talk Dr. Bob's Nightmare, I think it's 11 pages long, and he's drunk for 10 pages. I'm thinking, you know what, if it's good enough for the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think I should tell you what I was like out there a little bit. And this is another big reason, because when people would share those kind of stories and all they would talk about recovery, I wouldn't get anything, and you want to know why? It's really simple. It's because I got no recovery. There's nothing to like connect. There's nothing to, but you get these speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes, and they would come in and they would tell their stories, and there'd be a drunk log and the drug log and the blow by blows and the wrecking cars and the getting arrested and getting in fights and the mayhem that we create when we're out there. And I'm sitting in my seat going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And the thing was, is all of a sudden I'm identifying. And what I really loved about those speakers is they had a really amazing way of being able to weave Alcoholics Anonymous into the middle of their stories. And there's a great line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think the Big Book of AA is just about the best kept secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just one of my opinions. In the doctor's opinion, in the back of the book it says there are three things that are indispensable to recovery, and that is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And the thing was, is that I didn't know how to be open-minded. As a matter of fact, I was really defensive when I got here. I was going to shut you out, and you guys were not going to brainwash me. I actually remember going to meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked up a drunk driving when I was really young, when I was like 17 or something like that at one time, and they made me go to meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wore a Walkman. If you don't know what a Walkman is, it's like an iPod, but it's actually how you can put cassettes in it, and a cassette is something, never mind, anyway, you know, that's always, I've heard somebody else say that, and it was funny, you know, but I would wear a Walkman, and I got my 6 signatures of Alcoholics Anonymous at that particular time, and I remember getting that. I was going through something called the Right On Foundation. John Marshall Armstrong had put together this thing, and it was connected to the courts. I did my 6 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and off I went, but you guys weren't going to do that kind of stuff for me. So I think it's important for me to tell you what I was like out there. I really do. And I grew up in La Crescenta. I actually live in the town that I grew up in, where I partied and got loaded in, did all my damage, created all the wreckage that I did when I was out there. And I don't know if anybody else kind of identifies with this or not at all, but when I was a kid, my parents got all my clothes at thrift stores. And I don't know if you remember, like, the beginning of a school every year. When I was a kid, you know, I don't know about you, but my kids go to school year round now, it seems like. But when I was a kid, you had the summer off. I don't know if you remember that. I mean, we're talking like 93 days of summer. You get off in June, you throw all your books away. It's like, and off you go. And it was like an amazing adventure. You know, 3 months of just doing what you want, running around, digging boards, playing, and, you know, running around, just doing all the stuff that we do when we're out there. And then you go back to school in September. And when I was growing up, like I said, my parents bought all my clothes at thrift stores. And La Crescenta is kind of what I call it's a high-end blue-collar, low-end white-collar neighborhood. That's the best way to describe La Crescenta. And what it was is that when at the beginning of every school year, I didn't know if I actually saw this, but it seemed to me that everybody got like brand new school clothes, but not me. My parents bought all my clothes at thrift stores. Everybody else was getting like 10 or, you know, 8 or 10 brand new pairs of 501 button fly jeans, Nike and Puma tennis shoes, and white pressed t-shirts. And my parents are buying all my clothes at thrift stores. They're buying used boots. And I'll tell you this right now, if you're on the schoolyard, everybody else is wearing tennis shoes and you're wearing boots, you are a goober. There's no other better word to describe it. There was an old timer in Alcoholics by the name of, in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the name of Bobby Swanson. And I love the old timers. I call them the ghosts of AA, the ones that have passed on. And when he used to share in meetings, he used to catch my attention quite a bit. And one of the things that he used to say when he would share, and I wasn't identifying with what anybody was saying, he would say when he was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, he felt like a turd with eyeballs. Now that guy got my attention because it's exactly the way I felt. I didn't feel like I fit in. I don't feel like I belong. Now, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you I'm an alcoholic because my parents bought my clothes at thrift stores. My parents grew up in the Depression era. Their idea of love was there's meat in the freezer. Their idea of love is you live in a good neighborhood. I actually remember this, and Katie loves this story. She maybe tells the story every once in a while, and I do this. One year for Christmas, I wanted a set of walkie-talkies. I don't know if you ever wanted something so bad when you were a kid, and I wanted a set of walkie-talkies. And I thought I got it across. I don't know if you've ever telegraphed what you wanted for Christmas to your parents really bad. I don't care if Santa gives it to me, if the dog is, I just want this thing. And so Christmas morning, I wake up and there's a package under the tree. And I open the package, and in it, it's not a set of walkie-talkies, it's a walkie. It's like one. And then my dad had gotten at a thrift store, and I'm like, well, what the hell am I supposed to do with a walkie? And he says, find somebody else who has one. You know, I'm like, you know, and again, I'm not an alcoholic because I got a walkie for Christmas, but, you know, it kind of gave me a feeling of, you know what, people are better than me. You know, the other people deserve nice stuff, but I don't. You know, and one of the things that I always wanted was, I always wanted my own room. I have brothers and sisters, and I wanted my own room. It's just the way it was. You know, What it was is I, you know, he introduced me as Treehouse David in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get nicknames in AA. I know a guy they call Non-Controversial Steve, another guy they call Ungrateful Bud, another guy they call Never Late Jim. And you know, it's like, and I'm sure there's somebody in this room right here tonight that has a nickname in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you have a nickname in Alcoholics Anonymous, it has some reflection on your personality, either positive or negative. You know, Never Late Jim, 15 minutes late to every meeting he went to. You know, Non-Controversial Steve would argue with everybody. Ungrateful Bud, he was a big guy in Alcoholics Anonymous down in the Orange County kind of area, and you know, and that kind of stuff. These are just the nicknames you get. In Alcoholics Anonymous, that's my nickname. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it's Treehouse David. And the reason why they call me Treehouse David is because I spent a brief period of my life that I was out there drinking and getting loaded, living in a treehouse that I built in my parents' front yard. And that brief period of time was 10 years. Now, that just kind of gives you an idea. I don't play well with others. I really don't. And what it was is I wanted my own room. And so what I did is I had seen this treehouse somewhere, and I decided I'm going to build this treehouse in my parents' front yard. There's a big oak tree in my parents' front yard. And a big, you know, one of those ones that have like multiple, you know, coming up, trunks coming up, and there's a nice center part. And I ended up building this treehouse in my parents' front yard. And when I was done, it was actually pretty nice. I had a room. It was about 20 feet in the air. It was about 8 feet wide. It was about 15 feet long. I made it so you could stand up in it. I tar papered the roof. I ran electricity up there. And I had like a light, and I had like my own little place in the sky. Now stop and think about what I just described to you for just a moment. A room 8 feet wide and 15 feet long. What did I just describe to you? It's a cell. You know, and I love that line back to the best kept secret in Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book of AA. It says we live in a self-imposed crisis. Nobody did this to me. I did this to myself. But the thing was that I was kicking back up there a couple weeks after I'd finished it. And I don't know about anybody else in here, but you know what? All I ever wanted to be was cool. I wasn't cool. I was the goober. I was the guy. I don't know if you ever remember when they would pick like dodgeball teams and soccer teams and football teams and stuff like that. I was never a team captain. I was never like the first string or the second string or the third string. It got down to the point where there'd just be like two of us left, and they go, you know what? You take David and we'll take Susie with the crutch. And it's just like, man, I don't want to play anyway. And you know what they're doing? They're publicly humiliating me, and I don't like that feeling. I'm what my friend Nancy calls as a D-stop student, which basically means that I deserve enough, but they're tired of looking at you. I don't know if there's anybody else in here besides me that used to get happy about getting D-minuses. I used to like getting D-minuses because, man, at least I passed. You know, it didn't matter how I got it, you know. And so anyway, I'm kicking back, and like I said, I didn't fit in school. I didn't have the right clothes. It seemed like everybody was better than me, and I couldn't have told you this. Hindsight is 20/20. This is a direct result of coming in here, of applying the steps, of doing an inventory, of sharing with another human being. You know, and there's a great line in the book where it says, we won't get over this until we share all of our life story with somebody, you know. And that's basically what it was. I didn't know this, you know, but all I ever wanted to be was cool. And all of a sudden, this day, a couple weeks after I finished my treehouse, this guy from up the street came down. This guy's name was Mark, and Mark was like the coolest guy I knew. Mark had hair down to the bill of his back. Mark drank. He did drugs. He partied. He had money and girlfriends. And he said, hey, David, do you want to party? And what I heard was, you want to hang out with the coolest guy you know? That's what I heard. And I said, absolutely. And he came up there that day, and I caught a buzz. And it wasn't just a little bitty buzz. It was a great big buzz around the top of my head down to the ends of my toes. And I started to laugh. And I laughed, and I laughed. I laughed so hard. I threw up. I laughed so hard. I don't know if you ever remember laughing that hard about something. And then something happened inside of me. Now, I'll tell you something. When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous and sitting around the meetings and wishing desperately that this would work and knowing that it wouldn't, and I would hear people say certain things, and we call them the apropos or the buzzwords of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like, easy does it, live and let live, and you too can stay sober. You know, and like, what are they talking about? One of the phrases that I used to hear that drove me crazy all the time was this one. I was restless, irritable, and discontented. Came into Alcoholics Anonymous, got a sponsor. Don't know what a sponsor is. I did an inventory. Inventory is when you count nuts and bolts and you put them away and you give somebody the numbers. And I did all this kind of stuff and I got a sponsor. And now everything is awesome. You know, and I would say that doesn't mean anything. Restless, irritable, and discontented. What are they even talking about? I've been explaining to you for the last 5 minutes or so what it means for me to be restless, irritable, and discontented. And when that guy came up there that day, it went away just like that. I don't know how well alcohol and drugs work for you, but that's how well they work for me. And hear this if you hear nothing else tonight. I absolutely love alcohol and drugs. I don't like them just a little bit. I absolutely love them. And I don't say that in a past tense phrase. I still love alcohol and drugs. And if I could drink and get loaded and get away with it, I wouldn't be here tonight. I'd be out there just getting loaded and doing what I do, but I can't, because when I drink and I get loaded, I pay a really, really, really big price. One of the lines in the big book, it says, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is to take a half a dozen drinks and get away with it. That doesn't mean I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I show up and I show up here for 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks in I go out and I drink a 6-pack of beer, and 2 weeks later I come in here and take a dirty 30-day chip. We don't have AA police, you know, they're gonna go, you're taking a dirty day chip. They don't have that kind of stuff here. But that's not what we're talking about. We're saying take a half a dozen drinks and getting away with it. We're talking about not paying the price. And I'm one of the people that believes in the progression of the disease of alcoholism. And if you've ever had Father Tom from up in the Bay Area down here, he gives it an amazing analogy. And I stole it from him and I've used it ever since. And that's what the alcoholism goes into three basic stages. The first stage is fun with no problems. The second stage is fun with problems. And the third and final stage of the game is problems with no fun. That's exactly the way it worked out for me. But in the beginning, I absolutely loved what it did for me, because it not only made me just as good as you know what? It made me just a little bit better. And nothing changed except some chemical I had put into my system. Oh. Man, the best analogy I've ever been able to come up with is this one. You know, I was reading this book, and there's a monk, and this is a true story. This monk is named Dom Perignon. He basically invented champagne. And what happened was that he was upstairs, and they had one of those big two-story monasteries and wherever in France, wherever they make champagne at. And he was cooking on it and sipping and cooking and sipping and cooking and sipping. He drank a little bit too much, and he ended up falling down the stairs of the monastery. Took a whack, and he's laying at the bottom of the stairs. And all the other monks come running up, and they surround him, and they're all looking down at Dom, and Dom's looking up at them. I don't know if anybody else has ever been in that situation. I have been in a couple of times, but in this particular one, you know, and they're looking down at him, and they're like, Dom, what happened? And he looks up at them and he says, I have been drinking stars. I don't know about anybody else, but when I read that, it ran chills down my spine, because that's exactly what it's like when I drink and I get loaded. It's like it makes me one with the universe. I absolutely love the effect. I absolutely love the effect. And basically, it didn't matter what it was. From that day forward, if you told me it would get me drunk, if you told me it would get me loaded, if you told me it would catch me a buzz, I would take it, drink it, huff it, puff it, shoot it. I didn't particularly care. And I know I'm not the only other person like that in here tonight. Is there anybody in here besides me that smoked banana peels? There's usually at least some of us, you know. Yeah, absolutely. And you remember the song? There was even a song. It's called Mellow Yellow by Donovan. You know what pissed me off is that it didn't work. If there's a song, it should work. That's just my opinion on that one, you know. And I'm the kind of guy that, you know what, if I walk into your house, your vanilla extract is in danger. Only a real alcoholic's going to catch that one, you know, because that's like 40 proof. You smell like cookies for a couple of days, but if you're having a bad Jones, it'll get the job done, you know. And it's absolutely insane. And when you're 14, 15, 16 years old, you need a place to party. And people would just come by my treehouse to party. And I only had one rule. You got to share with me. I love that rule. Man, I got loaded a lot for free. And I would just sit up there and I would start partying and drinking all the time. And I completely dropped out of school. And I kind of mentioned earlier that the one question that people started to ask, you know, what are you going to do with your life? And it's always well-intentioned, good-meaning people that are asking you this particular question. You know, it's usually like, you know, your parents. Then it's like your teachers, if you're going to school. If not, then it's local police officers. And then it's the judges. And then it's your attorneys. And then it's the prosecuting attorneys. Then it's your probation officers. And people are just, what are you going to do with your life? And like I said, I used to feel cornered by that question. You know, all I know is I just want to drink and party all the time. This is what I want to do. And now I feel cornered by this question, what are you going to do with your life? And what happened was, when I was 16 years old, I read the life story of Jim Morrison. If you don't know who Jim Morrison is, he was the lead singer of a group called The Doors. Jim Morrison basically drank and used himself to death. And he abused himself to death with alcohol and drugs, and they found him dead in a bathtub in France at the age of 27 years old. Literally abused himself to death. The book was called No One Here Gets Out Alive, and which is a line from one of his songs. And I remember reading that and getting to the end of the book. They find him dead, and I remember thinking to myself, oh yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to be like a rock star because I can't sing, I can't play a musical instrument, and I don't want to come down out of my tree. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to drink and use myself to death. And I decided when I was 16 years old that I was going to die when I was 25 years old. Live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse, the James Dean theory of life. I love the self-deception of the practicing alcoholic, you know? Because if you looked at me and you said that, it was just like, yeah, I'm going to burn my life to the ground. It's better to burn out than fade away. I'm going to live my life like a rock and roll lyric, you know? The twisted poet artist, stick a shotgun in your mouth, blow your brains out, you know? Be the part of the 27 Club, you know, that kind of a thing. And but I'm 25 because why even take it to 27? Just 25, you know. And that's what I would tell myself, the twisted poet artist thing. This is the truth. Now I have a pat answer to that question that I feel so cornered by. What are you going to do with your life? You know, build a bright outlook for my future. You know, do those kind of things that the book talks about. And the book refers to it as we pull it down by a senseless series of sprees. But the truth was is that, you know what? I just decided I wasn't going to do any of that kind of stuff. You know, I just said, you know what? I foresaw my future. And this is the way it's going to go. Why should I bother do any of that bourgeois stuff that's part of your mundane world? You know, I'm not going to do any of it, you know. And in my treehouse, I don't know if anybody remembers the blacklight posters that they used to have. I had them all over my treehouse. My favorite one had a theme on it. And it was called The Last Great Act of Defiance. And if you've ever seen this poster, you remember it. And what it is that there's an eagle coming down. And there's a mouse, like, on the ground. And the mouse is, like right here. And the eagle's talons are like this. And this mouse is eagle breakfast in the next nanosecond. There is no way this mouse is getting away. And the mouse has his finger up in the air just like that. And at the bottom of the poster, it gave you the definition of defiance. Open disposition to resist. And I'd sit up in my treehouse and I'd go, yeah, come and get me. And they did, and I'll get to that in just a couple of minutes. You know, now I'm getting to the point where I'm getting it. Now it's fun with problems, and I get into that stage of the game. And now what it is I'm getting into some trouble now. I don't know about you. Is there anybody in here that used to buy any booze at Trader Joe's? Is there any Trader Joe's drinkers in here besides me? There's always a couple of us. When I was out there drinking, there was a Trader Joe's brand vodka. They still sell it to this day. They actually have like a whole string of it, and it was called Vodka of the Gods. It was $4.99 for half a gallon. You could strip paint off of chairs, but it got the job done. But I used to have like pride. I don't know about you. We had that self-deception that we had the pride. I'd be drinking the Vodka of the Gods, you know, and I would drink that with the Rainier's Ale. And I'm a pig when I drink. There is no middle of the road for me. I might be shooting for a 1.6, but I always end up in the 2.4, 2.9 area when I'm getting drunk. And I can't stop. I don't have a shut-off valve. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. Once I get started, I can't stop. One of the classic signs of being an alcoholic. Once we start, we cannot stop or moderate. And that's the way it was for me. And I used to get in a lot of trouble behind that. I always like to say that if you have to have a drunk driving to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not required, but it helps if you're polishing up your AA resume. I got a drunk driving. I got mine on a moped. If you don't know what a moped is, basically it's a motorized bicycle. And see if anybody identifies with this particular emotion. I'm at a party one night, and I'm afraid I'm not going to get my fair share. Are there anybody in here that identifies with that? You know, anybody like that? We're the not my fair share group. We really are. You know, I'm not getting my fair share. And I was at a particular party one night, and there was a big ice chest full of beer. And every time I went by the ice chest full of beer, I had this big P Army coat on. And I would grab an extra beer when I thought nobody was looking until it's like one for me, one for my jacket. One for me, one for my jacket. Till it got to the point where I couldn't even get any more beer in this coat. And I turned to walk away, and you could hear the bottles clanking and stuff like that. And I think I'm being slick. I think I'm being cool. I think I'm getting away with something. But hindsight is 20/20. In my mind's eye, I look and I see them saying, at least he's leaving. You know, and I got on that moped, and I don't know if anybody else in here, did anybody else in here besides me buy like a perfectly good used vehicle and inside of 6 months to a year just have it dying of alcoholism? I don't know if you've ever had a vehicle dying of alcoholism. There's only two rules to a vehicle dying of alcoholism. Can you get it started, and can you keep it running? Everything else is negotiable, you know, it really is. And my moped was dying of alcoholism by this particular time. It had no headlight for a spark plug wire. It had a coat hanger going from the distributor to the spark plug, which is fine as long as you don't brush your leg up against that thing while it's running, you know, if you ever been zapped, you know what I'm talking about. And I went driving down the middle of Foothill Boulevard and with this beer full of, your coat full of beer, and once again, I felt picked on and persecuted by the police out there that particular night. They pulled me over, and I remember thinking to myself, and the self-deception is unbelievable. I remember thinking to myself, I wonder why they're pulling me over. I got no headlight. I'm zigzagging in and out of the broken yellow lines, and they pulled me over, you know. And I remember going, oh, this sucks, man. And they impounded my moped. I thought that was rude. It's a moped, you know. And I ended up going to court a couple of months later, and they said, Mr. Delbus, we need your driver's license. And in my opinion, I didn't need a driver's license. Thank you very much. I know how to drive. I don't need a driver's license. They said, if you don't get a driver's license, we're going to put you in jail for a month. And I went, maybe I should go get my driver's license. And I don't see anything because I see the light, but because I feel the heat. And the heat was on that particular day. And I went out. I was like 18, 19 years old by this particular time. And what happened was that I ended up getting my driver's license. And I was kind of proud of that. Now, keep in mind, I've been living in a tree for about 5 years by this particular time. I got nothing going on. I dropped out of school. I'm just drinking, doing drugs all the time. I'm just creating mayhem, basically. And I got nothing going on. And now all of a sudden, I get a driver's license, and it may not sound like a big deal, but all of a sudden I got some tangible piece of evidence. I can touch it, I can hold it, I can stick it in my pocket, I can show it to you. It's there. And I show back up to court, and they said, "Mr. Delbus, did you get your driver's license?" I said, "Yes, I did, Your Honor." And you know what they did with that driver's license? They revoked it. I'm like, why do I even bother to try? The minute I get up, they just push me back down. It's always outnumbered and always outmanned, you know? I figure, why would I even do this kind of stuff? It's just absolutely crazy. I'm also an unsuccessful suicide. I don't know if there's any other unsuccessful suicides in here tonight, you know? But I am an unsuccessful suicide. Thank God for that. And the thing is that what happened was one night I was getting drunk. I was always getting drunk, but this one particular night I got really, really drunk and decided I was going to break into my friend's house, steal some stuff and keep the party going. And she caught me. And I decided I don't know if you've ever done what I call the Tom Sawyer Huck Finn thing. And that's where you imagine what your funeral is going to be like. You know, what they're going to say about you and all that kind of stuff. And they wish they'd treated you nicer and they'd be, we should have been better to David when he was around, you know, and that kind of stuff. And we do that kind of stuff. So I'm playing it out in my head and I decided I'm going to jump off the freeway bridge. Now, it seemed like a really good idea climbing up there. But once you get up there, something changes. And all of a sudden, I'm standing up there, I'm about 30 feet, 40 feet off of freeway ground. You know, it's concrete. Now, if I jump, two things are going to happen. I'm going to get royally screwed up or I'm going to die. Those are the things. And the thing is there's two guys, one on each one of my shoulder. One of those guys is my alcoholic ego. And it said, "You climbed up here to jump. You need to jump." And the other one is your sense of self-preservation that says, "If you jump, you're going to die. You can't do that." And it's back and forth and back and forth. I'll tell you this right now. Sometimes the wrong guy wins on that particular argument. My best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous is a case in point, Junior. He had 7 years of sobriety and a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Introduced me to Katie. Was the best man at my wedding. He was a good guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Always doing the right things. I swear, if you ever met this dude, you'd think to yourself, when he was like entrenched in Alcoholics Anonymous, based on his history and why he and how he got sober and the things that had happened on time and going all that kind of stuff, he thought, this is one guy who's never going to drink again on circumstance alone, let alone applying the principles in his life. After 7 years, he started smoking crack cocaine and going in and out and in and out and in and out. Then he got 2 years of sobriety. And then all of a sudden, right after he got 2 years of sobriety, he called me up and he said, "David," I went back out and I said, "Let's just go to a meeting." And I said, and he goes, "Okay, we will." And 8 days later, his wife called me and said, "You know what? He's gone." And he hung himself on one of those shower curtain rods in the middle of Hollywood, you know, in those hotels, doing the things he did. And people tell you that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous swing both ways, but it ain't swinging back for him. I know where he's at right now. I go and visit him every once in a while, and he's still there. And the thing is I got to remember that. I can't forget that. It's a killer disease. We forget that so much. A friend of mine, Chuck, says this. It's just like, you know what? This is a disease, and we need to remember this, that it's going to be treated. One way or another, it's going to be treated, either chemically or spiritually. Those are our options, but it's going to be treated. And, you know, here I am, I'm standing up on this freeway bridge, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do, and some guy pulls up, and some guy I barely knew from school looks and sees me and goes and sees me up there and goes, "Don't jump." And I think to myself, thank God, I got someone to talk me down. And I went, "I won't." And I climbed down off of that bridge. I got into his car and we went to a party. I don't know if that sounds odd to anybody in here besides me, but that's just the kind of stuff we do. You know, and now I'm getting into the stage of the games where I'm getting in a lot of trouble behind the booze. I'm getting in fights with people twice my size. I'm wrecking that moped. I'm doing things that I shouldn't be. I'm doing all that stuff, that classic stuff that I wish people wouldn't see me doing. And I decide I need to quit drinking. But for me, the monster must be fed. And I absolutely love the definition of what it means to be an alcoholic in the doctor's opinion of the big book. Back again to the best kept secret in AA, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the doctor's opinion, it says that we have an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body condemns me to drink against my will, and the obsession of the mind tells me I don't have the allergy of the body, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Intellectually, you might be sitting there going, yeah, that makes perfectly good sense. But the thing is that it's got to have more than that. I think one of the most overlooked, understated lines in the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we hear almost constantly in AA in chapter 3, and it says this, it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. Now, we had Mickey B. out just a couple of months back, and he said, I'm a fully conceded alcoholic, and I knew what he was talking about, you know? And that's what it is. It's just like, fully conceded. So it doesn't mean that I convince you that I'm an alcoholic, because the truth of the matter is I've been doing that all my life. It's once I convince you, this is one of the major tools I brought through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Once I convince you, whatever it is you think is good for me, my job is done. And the thing is that I don't even know I'm being insincere. I'm just so used to you going, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Because when I hear it, it sounds like you're right. But once it gets past like the conscious mind, something deep down inside of me says, no, that's not really, it's not really true. It's not really true. And deep down inside, you know, that's where it really counts. Because what comes down to it, if I'm shucking and jiving you, if I'm telling you I'm an alcoholic and I don't really believe it, when that dark night of the soul hits, I'm screwed, because I do one thing and one thing only, that's drink and do drugs on a constant basis. That's what I do. But I got to personify these steps. If they're not personal to me, they're just information. And I absolutely love this phrase. The mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted. It's about passion, you know? And the thing was, is that I got to personify these things. And if you've ever never seen this, this is how I personified that first step, what it means to be an alcoholic. As I saw this movie, and if you've never seen this movie, I highly recommend it. It's called The Little Shop of Horrors. Rick Moranis is in it. Steve Martin is a demented dentist. And what happens is there's a plant from outer space that lives on human blood. And what happens is Rick Moranis accidentally cuts his finger at this particular phase of this plant's existence, and it started, at the time, it's getting weaker and smaller. And at the point, it was like drawing people in. And all of a sudden, as it's getting weaker, it's not doing it. It's not, the flower shop isn't doing as well. And then all of a sudden, Rick Moranis cuts his finger, and the plant gets the blood and starts growing and getting stronger. Feed me, Seymour! And to me, that's the disease of alcoholism. He said, feed me, David! And the monster must be fed. And the monster is insatiable. The monster cannot be stopped. And what happened was I was getting a lot of trouble behind the booze, a lot of trouble, and I couldn't control it, I couldn't maintain. I'm a crier, I'm an unsuccessful suicide, I'm obnoxious, I'm rude, I get in fights with people, I do all that stuff that the book talks about. But I decide I need to quit drinking, but for me, the monster must be fed. The monster must be fed. So what I did is I switched. You know, they talk about in the book, you know, they switched from scotch to brandy, you know, drinking only natural wines, all these things. What I did is I switched to methamphetamines. And I love methamphetamines, man. I used to tell my friends, dude, I haven't had a drink in 6 months. I've only been asleep twice, but hey, sobriety through methamphetamines, man. And I got busy on that stuff. You don't go anywhere, but I got busy on that stuff. And when you're living in a tree, there's only one way to go, and that's up. So I built a room on top of that one, another room on top of that one. I ran cable TV up there. I had a whole bunch of stuff going on, and I was living large. Got down to 110 pounds. Told you. I thought I looked good at 110 pounds. You could see my skull in my face. You could see my eye sockets in my skull. And my friends would look at me and they would say, David, you're getting too thin. And you know what I think to myself? They're just jealous. That's what I would think. You know, I'd look in the mirror and they would say I look gaunt. The word I would use was chiseled handsome lady killer. That's the term I would use to describe myself. You know, that's what I thought. Again, the self-deception of practicing alcoholics, unbelievable, unbelievable. The thing is that if you stay up for long periods of time and take mass quantities of amphetamine, strange and bizarre things start to happen. And that's basically what happened. And all of a sudden I got paranoid. And I didn't just get a little like, ooh, I think they're following me. I got nasty paranoid. And all of a sudden they were out there. And if you've ever been like really, really bad paranoid, I'll tell you this right now. Being 20 feet in a tree is a bad place to be. I'll just tell you that right now. And all of a sudden they were out there and they were everywhere. And I'll just tell you a couple of the quick ones. I thought my parents were cyborgs. Big thing, the Terminator was big at the time. And I knew my parents loved me too much to be turning against me. So I believed that they had just simply come in and replaced my parents with cyborgs and that they were out to get me. My wife's favorite story is the federal squirrels. I'm living in a tree, so of course I have squirrels in my tree. Most trees do have squirrels. And if you're really paranoid, everything's about you. And they would run across the roof of my treehouse at like like 2 o'clock on 3 or 4 o'clock on Friday, whatever it was, you know, what's squirrel behavior. And I perceived that that wasn't natural squirrel behavior. Like I know different, you know, and I said, that's not the way squirrels behave, because they'd be running around and doing stuff. Because if you're paranoid, it's all about you. It's all about you. It doesn't matter what's going on. It's all about you. The wind blows. It's about you. Car drives by. It's about you. Squirrels drive, but running around. It's about me. And what I perceived was that these were not the natural behavioral squirrels. That what happened was that the federal government had a squirrel ranch like 3 houses down from my house, and was training squirrels and say, go get David on Tuesday at 2 o'clock. That's what I would think, and I would believe that, and I would tell my friends, dude, they got a squirrel ranch. The federal squirrels are coming, and they would look at you funny, and you know what I think, don't you? They're in on it, you know, and that's just the way it is. I got really bizarre on that stuff, and finally what happened was I decided the alcohol and the drugs were having a bad effect on me. I'm in the end stages of the game now. Now it's problems and no fun. There's no coming back from once you kick your doors and the mind open that way. And what happened was is that I finally convinced myself that I was having a bad effect, and I started doing this mantra of no one's coming to get me, no one's coming to get me, no one's coming to get me. And right when I convinced myself that nobody was coming to get me, you know what happened, don't you? They came and got me. But it wasn't the federal squirrels. It wasn't cyborgs. It wasn't Care Bears from outer space. I didn't have a chance to tell that story. But, you know, all these different stories, you know, it's like what it was the Glendale Narcotics Division. And what happened was I forgot to mention I was selling drugs to the local high school kids by this particular time in my life, you know, different things, and they didn't like that, so they were going to raid my treehouse. The problem was is they didn't know how to raid a treehouse, so they had to bring down fire truck, cops in riot gear. There's 20 cops out in my front yard, my dad's front yard, and coming to get me. And now, I don't know about anybody else in here. We talk about bottoms in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. And I don't know what your bottom is or what your bottom was, but this was my bottom. When they raided my treehouse, my father came out to see what all the commotion was, and he yelled up to me, he says, David, they're coming up. And they did. They came up and they arrested me, but they arrested my father for obstruction of justice, for calling up to me and warning me. And they stuck me in a holding tank with my dad. And it's my opinion they wanted to see if he would kill me. That's just my opinion on that one. And the truth was, I remember sitting in that cell and looking at my feet, and I finally pulled my head up after about 10 minutes, and I turned and I looked my dad in the eye, and I said those two words that alcoholics of my type are so famous for in situations like that. And you know what those two words are, don't you? I'm sorry. And we're the sorriest people in the world. If you've ever had the opportunity to go to court, you get an opportunity to cop a plea. You have three options. Guilty, not guilty, or my all-time favorite, no contest, which means guilty with an explanation. And I was always guilty with an explanation. And I don't know about this. I think one of the big lies that you and I tell ourselves is this one. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. One of the big lies that we tell ourselves, you know. I don't know about anybody else in here, but the people that really get hurt by our behavior, they aren't the random strangers that we come across. I mean, yeah, they get brushed back a little bit once in a while, and they go, but they move on with their lives. But the people that really get hurt by our behavior, the people that love us, the people who care about us, this is the way I put it, the people who have hopes and dreams in their hearts and in their minds for our lives. They want to see us succeed. Those are the ones. Those are the ones that we screw over. Those are the ones that we work over. Those are the ones that we say, please give me another chance. My big thing was, I'll get a job, I'll join the military, or I'll go back to school. Those were the three things that I would throw out there, and I would beg and I'd plead. I'd say, please give me one more chance when I get in some jackpot. And what happens is it's like they really want to believe. That's the thing. They want to believe. And what it is you, when you're working them, you can actually see that little glimmer of hope in their eye. And you got them. And what you do with that hope, you take it and you crush it. And you take it and you crush it. And you take it and you crush it. Until you get to the point where you can't even give it anymore. And it's not that they don't care. They don't want that for you anymore. It's just that they can't. We've done it. We've done too much damage, you know. And that was my bottom in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I can no longer believe the big lie. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And the kicker of it is you think that's just going to ruin you from that time forward? Sorry. What it does is it gives you a crystal ball into your past, and all of a sudden I can see all the damage I've been creating since before. I can see what I'm doing now, and I can see the damage it's going to create no matter what I do. And now we're in the end stages of the game, and it's not enough. Ill health, the warning of a doctor, falling in love, those kind of things. What the book refers to as, in a lot of ways, is a frothy emotional appeal. If these things become operative, or we apply them into a person who appears to, they can even be drinking what we might consider to be alcoholically, but all of a sudden they have some outside issue or circumstance and they can stop, but not me. I think one of the lines that kills people more than people like me more than anything else is you still drink or use no matter what. You know, that might get me through a bad spell. The apropos, easy does it, live and let live, you know, turn it over one day at a time. Those are good. They're like nice to get us through the door in a bad spot, but there's work that needs to be done. Bill Wilson says in his story, simple but not easy. A price has to be paid. He talks about the destruction of self-centeredness, you know, and that's basically it wasn't enough for me. You know what? All this knowledge, and Bill talks about it, you know, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. You're an alcoholic, my type, and I was out there for another 3 years, and I ended up going through it. Now, I don't know what your last year was like out there. My last year was a salty year. I had a tough year when I was out there at the end, and it was 1988, and I went through American Hospital in Pomona, and I was just trying a 28-day program, whatever they were doing there, for a detox. I was trying to stay out of jail, and then I ended up getting out of there, and I ended up turning in more dirty tests, and then I ended up going through Impact House of Pasadena, and I went there. I was there for 89 days. Got 89 days of sobriety. And then I got out of there after they threw me out. I never made it past their first phase of what they had going on. And I got kicked out of there, and I said, I'm going to stay sober. And I could not last 12 hours. I was loaded the next day, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. I cannot stay sober on my own power. The book talks about real alcoholics, alcoholics of our type, of our kind. Left my own devices, I do one thing and one thing only. That's drink and do drugs to the point of self-induced suicide almost. It really is. That's how bad it is for me. And it's not enough, you know. And it's not enough for me. And it's not. I just can't do it. And so I finally came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was December of 1988. December 19th of 1988. And I can't tell you what made that day any different than any other day, but that particular point. But I'll tell you this right now, I was done paying the price. I didn't want to do this anymore. I was 24 years old, 3 months before my 25th birthday. I had a ninth grade education. I'd been living in a tree for 10 years. I was bat nuts crazy, and I was just dying of this disease. And we're the only people in the world, and I mentioned it earlier, that we can come to you with this solution, either a spiritual way of life or an alcoholic death. And we're the only people to look at you and go, can I get back to you tomorrow on that? We're the only people that'll do that. And the thing is like, I've heard this shared, and I absolutely agree with this. You know, if you got somebody dying of cancer, they'd crawl through 3 miles of broken glass if all they had to do was some of the stuff that we ask people to do around here in Alcoholics Anonymous. When we say, you know, get a copy of the Big Book of AA, start praying to a God, get a sponsor. And I'll tell you this right now, I've done all those things, and I do all those things. And come in here and buy the package of AA. And what I did is I came in here and I started doing the things, not because I thought I overworked, because I did not know what else to do. I think this is kind of an interesting perspective. And the thing is that I've seen this happen. A lot of times we get people that have come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I bring up my friend Junior one more time. Again, my best friend. And I love Junior. I mean, he was my best friend. He's my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. We had plans in AA. And he ended up dying instead. But one of the things is that he would, like, when he started going in and out, and I would try to talk to him afterwards, and he would start telling me what he knew he needed to do. He'd go, I need to start calling my sponsor. I need to get a copy of the book. I need to do this. And the thing is it's just like when this is what I've discovered in talking to people and watching going down and being afraid that maybe, you know, I'm doing the same thing they're doing. Why am I still sober and they're not? And the truth of the matter is that it's because it's never the stuff in the light that drives us back out the doors, especially if we've been around here for a while. It's always the stuff in the dark. And I don't know if anybody remembers those Bazooka Joe comics that they used to have. And there was this great one that would happen. And Bazooka Joe goes walking by, and Fast Freddy is crawling around on his hands and knees. And Bazooka Joe says to him, he says, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for a quarter that I lost. Bazooka Joe goes, let me help you. So they start looking. And after about 15 minutes, he goes, well, exactly where were you standing when you dropped the quarter? And he says, well, I was about a quarter of the block up the street up over there. And he says, well, why are we looking here? And he says, well, the light's better here. And that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing is, it's never the stuff in the light that drives us out there. It's always the stuff that things that have been hiding in our soul. And that's why it's so important. I love that line in the book where it says we only thought we lost our egoism and fear until we told somebody else all of our life story. And I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was willing to do anything. I didn't think it was going to work. I thought I was wasting my time. I thought, why am I even here? Why am I even here? But I did it anyway. And it was hard. And I hope that if you're new, I hope sobriety's hard. Because for me, it had to be that way. It had to be to the point where it's like, you know, even getting up was a tough deal for me. I didn't like being awake, you know. Dr. Bob even says in his particular story that the desire to drink did not leave him for 2.5 years. 2.5 years. Could you imagine living with the obsession and not doing it? But he even says, because as a result of doing the stuff that he was doing, he came nowhere near to giving in because he was plugged in to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In Bill's story, it says, what happens is that the reason that people come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and keep coming out is because we fail to perfect and enlarge our work through self-searching and the sacrifice of others. And I'm paraphrasing that, but that's the stuff we got to do. Which is why when someone says, "Hey David, will you sponsor me? Hey David, will you do this in Alcoholics Anonymous? Hey David, do you still have a sponsor? Yeah. Hey David, why are you still doing all these things?" And the truth of the matter is because they work. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous does not change simply because I've been here 29 and a half years. I still need to do that kind of stuff. So like when Lee calls me up and says, "Hey, Dave, will you drive up, you know, 150 miles and share our meeting on this particular night?" I say, "Of course I can." But I'll tell you this right now. It's not always as simple as saying yes to every request in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the truth, and I learned this from my friend Don. The thing is there's people that say that AA has to be number one. And I agree with that. AA needs to be number one. But I'll tell you this right now. Sometimes my job is number one. Sometimes my family is number one. I'll tell you this right now. If I'm at a meeting, if I'm at work at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and somebody calls me up and says, "David, if you don't come and get me or I'm going to drink," do you think my boss cares if I go into them and say, "I am a spiritual guru in Alcoholics Anonymous and I must go save an alcoholic"? They don't care. They're paying me to be at my job 9 to 5. They want an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. And they don't, they know I'm in AA and they appreciate the fact, but the truth of the matter is they want me there. It says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is not a vocation, it's an advocation. I do this in my spare time. When I'm sponsoring guys, Saturday morning. You get like an hour and 15 minutes on Saturday mornings, because it's right in the middle of a lot of stuff, you know, 8 to 9, right around in there. And I get to work with people, but I've had people going, "You know, I don't give enough of my time to them." And it's just like, "You know what, I'm really sorry. I'm willing to give up my time, but it's got to be on the terms that I have available, you know." And I'll tell you this right now, Alcoholics Anonymous is number one. My work is number one. My wife is number one. My kids, my kids who have autism and demand my attention on a lot of different levels, they're number one. They really are. And I got to keep that in mind. And the thing is that it doesn't mean that I don't care about any of this stuff. All of this, I wouldn't have my family. I wouldn't have my job. I wouldn't have my wife and kids if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I'll share with this and then I'll sit down, you know. And the thing is that I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I encourage relationships in AA. I really do. I think they're a great thing. I love relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. I only have one caveat to a relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you have both done an inventory and you've both shared it with a sponsor. Other than that, if it's just like boy meets girl across AA campus, it's like two ticks and no dog. It's a lot of fun to watch, but God, you know, and usually when they're done, it's just like, "You ready to do some inventory work now?" You know, the thing is that we have an AA household. We've got an AA household right now. And the thing is that we do a lot of stuff. We do stuff in AA. We do stuff like we talked about, that I kind of mentioned about the family. We're in Boy Scouts. We're in Awana, which is part of the church. I got baptized last year, you know, and my spiritual growth is continuing on. Keep that in mind. When I talked about that, I said, why do people go out in Alcoholics Anonymous? They fail to perfect and enlarge their spiritual life through the work and self-sacrifice for others. Work and self-sacrifice for others, you know? Which is why we do the things we do, you know? And that's not to say I'm perfect. And I'll just tell you this right now, and then I'll sit down with this. When I came into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I planned on dying when I was 25 years old. Today, I want to live to be the oldest living member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to be at the International Convention one year going, "Thank you for this 100-year cake. I want triple-digit sobriety." That's what I want. My sponsor says, since I got sober so young, it's possible, you know. But you got to ask, and you got to be willing to do the stuff that we do around here. Get a copy of the book. Get a sponsor. Pray to God. Buy the package of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you guys for having me out tonight. Thank you.
Oh, boy. All right. Thank you very much, Dave. That was wonderful. Another round of applause, please.